Can you remember a time when a story just whacked you over the head?
I think one of the more difficult ones for me to write was Canoe, which is the last story in my collection. And I don't know if it whacked me over the head so much as it haunted me for a few years before I finally managed to get it down on paper. It was inspired by an incident that actually happened that really troubled me because at the time I was doing river guide school and spending a lot of time on the rivers. So the story of this river accident that I read in the news really stuck with me. And then a few years later, I happened to have two little boys of my own the same ages as the kids that were involved in this accident. And it came back and bothered me and bothered me. And so I ended up writing it about four different times from different points of view until I finally felt that I had found the story. But it was one that I felt I had to write and it wouldn't let me go.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from members of Montana Public Radio and from Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Dana Fitzgale about her award-winning collection of stories titled Spells for Victory and Courage. Several of the stories in this collection have unusual forms. For example, in Covenants, each section of the story is named after the color orange, and Schooling is divided into sections named after subjects, arithmetic, geography, physics. Do the forms for your stories develop as you write, or do you start writing a story with a certain form in mind?
Some of both, actually. I think sometimes I start writing and the form just organically seems to come up as the one that fits the story best. But other times I have pushed myself to try a different point of view or a different form just for the sake of trying to write outside of my comfort zone. I think that it's important to always try something new in my writing. If I'm finding myself getting bored and not discovering something new and not having fun with it, then I don't think that my readers are going to stay interested either. So I'm always trying to do something new, whether it's write in the third person plural as I did in Covenants, which was an odd challenge and just kind of a task I set for myself. Or sometimes I'll even kind of deliberately experiment with breaking one of the classic short story rules. For instance, I'd heard several people say that you should never shift points of view within a short story because a short story is too small and compressed for that. So in Jester, I have an alternating point of view, which was kind of a challenge again that I sent for myself to try to see if I could get away with it.
Let's go back to that plural point of view that you just mentioned.
Well, point of view is something that really interests me. Both when I teach writing, I really love to talk about point of view, and just as a writer and as a reader, I'm just fascinated in the ways that the same story shifts so much depending on who's telling it and how they're telling it. So it's something that is always in my mind. And I have a couple stories. The first story in the collection is told in the second person, the you voice, which is fairly unusual. And after trying that, I just had to see. There are a couple stories that have been written that I know of that are in the third person plural, the we voice, but it's not a voice that typically lends itself very well to fiction, since fiction is typically based on the individual narrator, not a group narrator. So it was just really something that I wanted to try and see if I could make it work. And what resulted was this group consciousness, a very conformist neighborhood, was what sprang out of my attempt at using a we voice, where individuality is often erased and the individual nonconformist becomes the target of this neighborhood's wrath.
Well, it was very interesting to read because you knew that it was more than one person telling the story, but you did it so smoothly that I didn't even think about the plural voice until you just mentioned it.
Oh, thanks.
So if you don't mind reading the entire thing, it's not too long. I'd like you to read the first story in the book called Schooling.
Schooling. Arithmetic. Arithmetic is easy. $40 placed on the dapple gray, win place or show, equals a cool 300. Glory be. Dumont, your paraplegic father, peels 220s off the top and hands the rest to you for safekeeping. Off he wheels to buy a celebration liter of Crown Royal. You, meanwhile, will do some shopping at the IGA adjacent to the racetrack parking lot. Dumont subsists on Fritos and beef jerky. But lately you've developed a mild interest in nutrition, so you toss a box of whole wheat crackers in the cart, on top of boxed potatoes, powdered eggs, and tuna fish. Ignore the cashier when she asks how old you are and why you aren't in school this time of day. Back at the lot, inside the Winnebago you call home, remember to tuck several bills into the zippered pencil case beneath your bunk. Don't worry, you can tell Dumont these groceries cost more than they really did. He never asks to see receipts. The remainder will be wagered on the blaze-faced chestnut in the 315, a horse called Lightning Finish, who will, sadly, prove unworthy of that name. History, a subject best ignored. You know full well it's better not to aggravate Dumont with questions on the subject of your mother, including who she was. She was 16 when you were born, that's all you know. And where she went, or why she left before you had a chance to get acquainted. It is especially prudent to avoid this subject when Dumont's been drinking, which is all the time. Geography. Dumont, possessing better social skills than most ex-jockeys, has become quite good at handling snoops and busybodies. He tells strangers, when they ask, that you and he are visiting from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. The two of you are in whatever town you're in to visit his wife's mother. You happen to be at the track because, like many girls your age, you have a thing for horses. So the story goes. The truth is, though you've lived at 18 racetracks in a dozen states, you've never even been to Tennessee, a place where gambling is illegal. Dumont just likes the way that word sounds, Murfreesboro. And besides, he figures, nobody's from there. Home economics. When supplies get low, mix extra water in the dehydrated milk. A little duct tape helps to keep the damp out of your boots. Make sure to check beneath the grandstands daily. You'd be amazed at how much spare change falls from race fans' pockets. Dumpster diving is undignified, unsanitary, best reserved for true emergencies like month-long losing streaks, or times when no one wants to pay a girl for odd jobs, pulling mains and cleaning stalls. Whatever happens, try your utmost not to touch the secret savings in your pencil case. Physics. 1,400 pounds of horseflesh coming around the curve, colliding with the rail at 30 miles an hour, will catapult a small boned man at least 10 yards into the path of a whole field of thoroughbreds, which, moving on the same path at a roughly equal speed, deliver the force needed to obliterate a jockey's spine between the second and third lumbar vertebrae. A horse would never be allowed to suffer so. Health. If your father were a thoroughbred, he would be dead, and you, who've had the sore luck to be born a filly in this no-frills world, had better not forget to watch your back. Stick to the lighted portions of the stable yard. Befriend the oldest groom at every track, in hopes that you'll remind him of his grandchild back in Guadalupe. And, if all else fails, recall Dumont's advice. A metal hoof pick makes the perfect implement for gouging eyes. Chemistry. Dumont's prescription pain pills mixed with gin can sometimes make him mean as snakes. It isn't that he wouldn't hit you if he could, but you are quicker, nimbler, having two good legs. Sometimes, when he believes you've been neglecting him because you've been out scrounging all day long to keep your bellies full, Dumont will howl that you are all the same, you females, treacherous and cruel. If you laugh, he is a spectacle, this tiny, raging, helpless man, he'll start in on his threats, the same ones you've been hearing all your life. He'll say, for instance, that he'll hunt you down and beat you senseless with a nickel-plated stud chain if you ever try to leave him like she did, ungrateful slut. When he starts talking this way, tip his wheelchair forward till he slides out. It won't be hard, he's such a featherweight. Be sure to clear the area of any objects he might throw before you leave him stranded on the floor to curse and flail until his eyes roll back. Then place a folded sheepskin saddle pad beneath his snoring head. And gently, very gently, roll his body to one side. You don't want him to choke. Music. First, the trot. A pair of eighth notes alternating. The canter has a 3/4 tempo, like a waltz. The Gallop is a symphony in 4/4 time and is the soundtrack of your father's dreams. You know this from the way his whip hand lifts and falls when he's asleep, and from the rhythmic spasms of his shoulder muscles. Art. A horse's breath is silver in the cold hours after dawn. Dumont and you are stationed in your customary place along the rail, between the first and second furlong markers. It doesn't matter that you watch the morning workouts every day, they still affect you. Every time a group of horses thunders by, you hold your breath. Your father grips the edges of his wheelchair, pushes up and forward, arms taut, neck out, like he's trying to fly. At times like this, you wonder if your secret plan requires courage or mere heartlessness. Biology. You learn this soon enough. Your teacher is a stable hand named Luke. Your classroom is an empty stall, a week before your 16th birthday. You'll find the subject disappointingly simplistic at the start, but we'll be quick to see how it might help to further your ambitions. Philosophy. Sometimes, hungover, Dumont turns all misty-eyed and metaphorical. He rolls past the rows of horses in their stalls, comparing them to inmates in a jail. He reaches up to stroke the muzzle of some wild-eyed 2-year-old who wears a sharp-edged metal yoke around his windpipe. He says he hates those goddamn cribbing collars. He tells you only captive horses have bad habits. All racehorses are cribbers, kickers, weavers, says Dumont. Or biters. Who can blame them? Dumont shakes his head and mutters in a voice almost too low to hear that all caged things possess the memory of freedom. English. English hurts. The past tense of the verb to leave is left, as in, she left while he was sleeping, having slipped 2 ground-up pain pills in his drink. The antonym of love is loss. Betrayal is a synonym for daughter. Arithmetic. It all comes back to this. Combine that $1,400 in your pencil case with the wad of C-notes Dumont hands you for safekeeping after he finally hits the daily double. Add, subtract. The sum is equal to a brand new start in life. However things turn out, don't blame your math. Hold your equations firmly in your head so you won't falter as you tiptoe past his bunk, won't stop to watch his whip hand rise and hover. Think about the money. It'll last, so long as Luke's truck doesn't throw a rod in Escondido and he doesn't spend a bundle on his hitherto concealed cocaine addiction. These things, of course, may never happen. Just as Luke may never leave you broke and stranded at some highway rest stop, in which case you can keep believing that you have an eye for winners. Either way, it doesn't change things, doesn't change the fact that years from now, after you've given up on searching and have sworn off racetracks altogether, you'll still be convinced you hear him now and then. Not Luke, your father. You'll be walking down some street, your mind on other things, and all at once, you'll think you hear his slurred voice calling you. Always and everywhere, you'll hear him, cursing, spitting, aching to forgive.
You've been listening to Dana Fitzgale read from her collection of stories titled Spells for Victory and Courage. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. mtpr.org is the place to listen on demand, or you can sign up for our podcast there. Once again, we're online at mtpr.org, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Do you find your characters in real life, or do they come out of your imagination?
None of them are based completely on a real-life person, as in I don't model them on people I know or somebody that I've met. So they're from my imagination and from my subconscious. But that said, things that I see or little even snippets of conversations that I hear sometimes will spark the beginning of a character, and then the imagination takes over from there. So I guess especially anything that I see, sometimes just the shortest little thing that catches my curiosity will lead me to start thinking about it and start wondering what that person is like. I think a lot of fiction is based on that perspective taking or putting yourself in another's shoes, which I find myself doing a lot. And sometimes the characters that seem the least sympathetic on the outside to me or the situations that I think are the strangest, I end up having the most empathy and love for those characters once I start exploring what they might be like inside.
Well, you have a knack for writing characters who seem totally normal, like someone who might live down the street from you. And then you throw in a sentence about something startling that leads the story off in a different direction. I'm thinking, for instance, of Leah Lamb. Just when I was starting to think that Leah is someone who's uncomplicated and simple, you throw in a box of cash, and the story goes in a whole different direction. What can you tell us about the process of creating surprises and a change of direction in a story?
Well, I feel like what you do in fiction when you explore a character and build a character is, I mean, it's really similar to getting to know somebody in real life, in that nobody in real life is actually as simple as we think. We might meet them or based on just observations or very quick encounter with them, we may form a lot of judgments about them. And in the case of Leah, I feel like I was kind of playing with a stereotype. I kind of self-consciously or deliberately set up a stereotype. She's this woman who's on her own and it's kind of a character we've seen before, the lonely widow who's about to be taken advantage of, and we feel like we know her, and it's very easy for us to fall into judgments about what she's like. And I think that we do that all too often when we meet people in real life, too, because nobody in the world actually fits into any of those categories. Nobody really is a stereotype. So I think the process of getting to know anybody beyond a surface level is really about discovering what makes them individual and unique, what their unique quirks are and how they differ from our preconceptions and our categories and our stereotypes of them. And I think usually the surprise happens as much for the writer as for the reader. At least it should. I feel that the process of writing is really about discovery. And if I'm not surprised as I'm writing, if I'm not learning something new or having those moments of epiphany that I didn't expect, then I certainly can't expect any growth in my character and I can't expect any rewards for the reader if it's all predictable. So I think the surprise should be as much there for the writer as for the reader.
In 14 Tips for Selling Real Estate, you managed to weave forest fires and Alzheimer's, a realtor, and a half-century love affair into one story. And this is another story that's divided into sections, and I would just like you to read tips number 7 and 8. And the realtor's name is Trish.
Tip 7. Don't forget, the kitchen is the most important room. Ask your realtor for ideas on how to give yours sparkle and pizzazz. Adele has left the fridge door standing open once again. Jack closes it, then wipes the scattered breadcrumbs from the counter, trying to contain his irritation. She used to be so tidy all the time. The clock above the stove says 1 o'clock. Trish isn't supposed to show up with her clients till 3:30, which means Jack has about an hour to kill before he needs to get Adele up, dressed, and in the car. He'll take her to the mall to walk around. She likes the mall. She doesn't get upset there usually. It hasn't changed that much in 30 years. He checks inside the oven. Clean, of course. Nobody's used the thing in months. It still works perfectly, though Trish, with her usual zest for squandering Jack's pension, has suggested that he ought to buy a new one. No, worse than that, she thinks Jack should replace all the appliances. She told him this last month. That color, she said, is a major ick. A major what? Said Jack. And he had wanted to tell Trish that his wife had picked them out back when they built the house. Adele had picked that color, harvest gold, not because it was in vogue, but because she liked the way it matched the foothills east of town. But he's not willing to discuss his wife with Trish, so he told her instead about the two-room cabin he'd grown up in, where his mother fed and clothed 4 kids without the aid of 1 appliance, gold or otherwise, because the power lines did not extend that far from town back then. He stopped himself before the part about how he and his 3 sisters had to take turns hauling water from the well. He could tell from the forced way Trish was smiling at him. She had heard all this before. Tip 8, communication counts. Remember that your real estate professional is always there to listen to your questions and concerns. On Sundays, Lisa calls. Today, she says, "Have you been eating, Dad?" "Of course." Tom says Mom didn't cook at all the last time he was there. Well, she gets frustrated, but we're doing fine. I actually know how to fix some stuff. "Like what, Dad? Corned beef hash? You can't subsist on corned beef hash, you know." "We're doing fine. How are the girls?" "They're great. I wish your house would sell. No offers yet?" "Not yet. It's, you know, the economy and this damn smoke. The fires are making things a little difficult. But Trish is bringing some clients by to see the place day after tomorrow." "Good, that's good. I saw your fires on our nightly news. They're not too close." "No, no," he says. "We're not in any danger. Don't you fret. Though lately I've been wishing that they'd just let them burn, you know? Just let them burn this place right to the ground. Save us a lot of hassle, don't you think?" He laughs. His daughter doesn't. "Dad."
"What?"
"Do you want me to come out there?"
"No. I mean, not unless you want to."
Silence.
That one word, silence, says so much. And that's one of the things I really liked about your stories. You didn't use extra words.
Thank you.
And I think that that's probably something you have to work at.
It is. Typically, my first draft of a story, any story, is about four times as long as the final draft. It's revision for me is largely a process of cutting things out. I always tend to write way more than I need, and then trying to get rid of all the connecting tissue and boil it down to the essentials, or kind of distill it to the main important ideas, is the hard part for me.
I noticed that even though there are several couples in these stories, the relationships don't really dominate the action. I'm thinking of Jack and the realtor, which you just read about. She comes in a larger part toward the end of the story. Big Jim's wife and E.C. Pardue, Astrid and the sheepherder, Leah and the revival preacher. Do you do that on purpose, or is that just what happened as you wrote? Plucking out one person out of that couple and then pairing them with another person in the story, but not in like they're having affairs or anything, because nobody is.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. Well, I think it's one of the classic story plots, the stranger comes to town, which certainly is Monsters of the Deep. A stranger who may or may not be a con man shows up in a town where everybody is related to each other and has known each other for hundreds of years, and the relationships are all established. And I think one reason that that is one of the classic plots for a short story is that things have to change. A short story has to be dynamic, and it doesn't have very much room for things to change. Whereas in a marriage, we easily settle into our patterns, whether they be good or bad patterns. Often it's a fairly static relationship, and it has to be to endure over decades. So I think maybe my strangers coming to town, the outside people coming in, are serving as catalysts of change of one form or another. And it's maybe easier for somebody from outside to come in and start those wheels turning.
You came up with such interesting characters. You know, the guy who brings the fish to town and says he caught it in the lake, and then a sheep herder from Mexico. I mean, just fascinating characters.
Thanks. The story about the big fish, the Monsters of the Deep, was actually inspired also by an historical incident, although it's fiction. There actually was a man who came to the Polson Fishing Derby in the mid-50s claiming that he'd caught the flathead monster. He had a huge sturgeon, and he touched off a controversy that ended up in the Montana Supreme Court back then. He won eventually, but there was a lot of resentment and a lot of anger, and people said he'd smuggled the fish in from somewhere else. So that was actually a tidbit of a story that I heard from my mom, who grew up in the Flathead Valley, that she remembered because she was there when it happened in the 50s. And I was just fascinated by the story. So it is fiction. The characters bear no resemblance to the actual characters. But again, I couldn't resist the idea of somebody, an outsider, coming into a very established world where the norms are set and everybody has their roles to play, and just disrupting that universe a little bit.
That was so fascinating to think about in that story, because how are you going to get a fish that big, especially in the 50s? How are you going to transport it from somewhere else, and where would he have caught it?
In the actual story, they believed he got it at the Columbia Gorge and drove it in his Airstream trailer. He actually did show up with an Airstream. And the fish, the sturgeon that he caught, is on display in the Polson Historical Museum. It's not quite as big as I made it in my story. Like any fish story, I exaggerated, but it is there for the curious to go see. So I think it's a fascinating little-known piece of Montana history.
It is.
This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Dana Fitzgale about Spells for Victory and Courage, her award-winning collection of short stories.
What's the significance of the title?
It was a line in one of the stories in the book. I lifted it from Angel of Barn 4. It's part of a sentence in there, and I just liked the sound of it and decided to make it the title. I like the magical connotations of the title, the spells. I have a couple stories where I was playing a little bit with the boundaries between the real and the imaginary. Although I'm generally a realistic writer, I think I do like some of those magical motifs, like the monsters, the monster legends from Flathead Lake. I think the vaquero is a bit of a mythical figure who straddles the line between real and fantastical.
You may have already answered this just by talking about where your stories come from, but why do you write short stories instead of, say, novels?
That's a good question. I think the easy answer is that I'm incredibly busy. I could always really relate to what Alice Munro said about why she wrote short stories, which was that she had three little children and no time, and short stories are shorter than novels. Although, in truth, it never made a lot of sense because Alice Munro's short stories are very long, and she said that she revises each one about 40 times. So it's not that hers are much a time saver in any way. But I am a mother with a full-time job, and so the length of the short story is somewhat less intimidating. I also like the excitement, though. I like creating new worlds and changing them frequently. As I said, writing is about discovery for me. And so writing a bunch of different stories with different characters and different worlds that weren't even linked to each other in any way, it was very exciting for me and allowed for a lot of discovery and a lot of experimentation, which I think I would not have. I might have been a little more bored sticking with a novel and the same characters in the same situation for that long. So maybe a personality issue.
Well, I don't want you to go off and write novels. I want you to write more stories. These are great. I just really admire anyone who has children who can ever get anything done besides their job and their family. So,
yeah, well, it's a very slow process, definitely. I think the only way to do it is to get up very early while everybody's still asleep and try to do some writing before the daily chaos starts.
Dana Fitzgale lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her and her book and sign up for a podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, you'll find children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening and for your financial contribution. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.